Thank you, Marston. I'd like to say, as the other speakers have said, big thank you to the organisers. It's been a terrific conference. I came here to learn, and there's been a lot many opportunities to do that. I'd particularly like to thank the speakers for making sure they explain the concepts they were talking about and so on. And even though this is a very specialist conference, they've done a wonderful job of explaining that. So in that spirit, I'll try to do the same. So the topic is of my talk, the symmetries in the Cohen-Miller space, might not be exactly on topic with symmetries of polytopes and maps, but there are a lot of overlapping concepts. And hopefully that will become evident. So the first overlapping concept is this is really a talk about Coxeter groups. Some of them, not finite Coxeter groups though, the opposite, universal Coxeter groups. So as just free products of groups of order 2. And I'm going to talk about their order morphism groups. So Wn is the free product of n groups of order 2. And the first thing, if we really want to understand the structure of the order morphism group, we just make this simple observation that in this group there are exactly n conjugacy classes of involutions. Each is represented by a generator. So then we have a... just an abstract group so far. That's right. And what the idea here is that there is a simplicial complex that's built for this space, and it turns out to be just the right complex. That's the theme that we're going to get at. The observation that there are n conjugacy class of involutions gives us a set of size n on which the order morphism group acts. So if we think about the order morphism group of this universal Coxeter group, there's a very natural semi-direct product structure because it acts on this set of size n. So we've got the symmetric group, which acts by permuting the conjugacy class of involutions. And if you think about it, of course, any permutation of the generators induces an order morphism. And then we have the kernel of that action. So that this consists of the order morphisms which map each generator to a conjugate of itself. And so this is, of course, the bulk of the group, and it's infinite as soon as n is 3. So, in fact, it's infinite when n is 2 in this case for the order morphism group. So what we need to know to understand how to start thinking about this order morphism group is that this kernel is generated by what's called partial conjugations. It's where you take one of the generators and you conjugate it by one of the other generators. Or you take some subset of generators and you conjugate it by the same generator. So we can conjugate, we might choose A1 and we'll conjugate A2 and A5 by A1 and we'll leave the other order morphisms alone. That's a set of generators for the kernel of this action. The issue here, what we'd really like to talk about here is the outer order morphism groups. So that's when we take the order morphism group and we declare inner order morphisms. Oh, that should be a W, I'm sorry. I was giving away some of the motivation here. That should be a W. We declare inner order morphisms to be trivial, and so we get this semi-direct product structure here. And this is an infinite group provided n's at least 3. So we're trying to understand an infinite group, which is the group of order morphisms of a Coxeter group. So why take an interest in the outer order morphism group of Wn? So here's where we start to see the connections to some ideas that came up in the talk we just heard from the Roman's talk. So there's a big theme in the study of order morphisms of free groups. And the theme is that the motivation for the study and how a lot of recent progress has been made is to capitalize on the analogies that we can see between the order morphisms of free groups and other well-studied groups. And it starts with the observation, so this is a direct quote from a textbook by Benson Farb and his former student Dan Margolit. We have that these three groups are isomorphic. So this is the GL2Z, the general linear group. This is the extended mapping class group of the once punctured torus. So one of those ones is for a puncture and one for a genus. And this is the outer order morphism group of the free group of rank 2. They're the same group. So you can therefore think of these families of groups as three generalizations of the same group. And that's been a very productive analogy. It's hard to overstate how important this has been to the development of the theory of outer space, because people have taken machinery that's been developed for mapping class groups. They've been of interest for a very long time, and they've just thought about what it would mean to adapt that to working for outer automorphisms of free groups, and they've come up with it just works. It works a bit more than maybe it should, but it's been very productive. So here, along those lines, here's something which is not as exciting, not as classical, but nevertheless of the same vein, that if we take PGL2Z, that's the same as the, this is the extended mapping class group of an orbifold, as Roman introduced in the last talk, with genus 0, so it's on the sphere, 3 cone points of order 2, and a puncture. A cone point of order infinity is a puncture. So, and then this is the same group as the outer automorphism group of W3. There are some other natural connections between this and this. And the idea is that these connections are really sharp for this small number, and then they fade away as the numbers get bigger. But nevertheless, and that's what happens here too, but the analogies are rich and work for us. So we can build on this, and this is enough for me to take an interest in that. Plus, it's just it's good fun. I don't think this is not. I think these sorts of groups have often been overlooked as not really being all that interesting. But there's things we can do there, and I think they're worth exploring because of their relationship to these very important groups, and because we're taking more of an interest in these orbifolds. Okay, so now we're going to use a slightly unusual language for group actions. This language comes from a paper by Brideson and Voetman. So I'm going to say a simplicial complex is a geometric model for a group if there's a homomorphism from the group to the automorphism group of the simplicial complex. We just know that's a group action. But we could call that a model, and of course, the smaller the kernel of the model, the less the model simplifies the group. That sounds good. The larger the image of the group in the automorphism group, the greater the expectation that simplicial complex is going, the automorphism group of the simplicial complex in its entirety is going to inform us about the group we're interested in, rather than so you sort of have a feel that this simplicial complex might be closer to being a really good picture of the group. And so one way to capture this is just to say we have an accurate geometric model if we have an isomorphism. And of course, within this conference we've seen lots of accurate geometric models of groups. In fact, starting with a group and trying to construct an accurate geometric model or is, of course, a very important task, and I don't need to tell the people in the room just how much insight that gives you into the groups involved. So here's some groups with some accurate geometric models, and we've heard about some of them in this conference. Of course, algebraic groups satisfying certain hypotheses, you have the spherical building, and it was Titz who developed this and proved he had an accurate geometric model. Mapping class group associated to a surface of genus at least 2 has an accurate geometric model called the complex of curves. And these names are not the names of the people who first introduced the complex of curves, but of the people who showed that it was an accurate geometric model. So, yeah. Yes. These are just the finishing touches to that. Many people have worked on these things, and if I've overlooked someone, I apologise. Right, and then the outer automorphisms of FN have the spine of outer space, possibly the best named concept in mathematics. Outer space is a topological construction, an ideal simplicial complex equipped with an action of the outer automorphisms of FN, and that's an accurate geometric model. And what I wanted to do today is just describe an accurate geometric model for the outer automorphism group of WN. So McCullough and Miller introduced this space and the group action, and my contribution was just to show that and the group action was known to be injective. My contribution is to show it was surjective. So McCullough and Miller space, to do justice to their construction, it's a very general construction. It works for an arbitrary group. I'm only going to think about it in one case, but it wouldn't be right to present it to a new audience and not point out that it's a very general construction. if you're given an arbitrary group and a fixed decomposition of the group as a free product of groups, and of course we have the Kirsch subgroup theorem to help us work with free products, we can think of the symmetric outer automorphisms. These are the outer automorphisms which first permute the free factors that we have chosen and then act by conjugation on each free factor. So we can do that for any group. For some groups, that's a bigger part of the automorphism group than others. But we can always... McCullough-Miller space is a contractible simplicial complex equipped with an action. So it's a geometric model for the symmetric outer automorphisms. And a space is constructed by gluing together copies of a finite simplicial complex called the hypertree complex, which I'm going to describe. We're just going to work with a particular case. So Km will be the McCullough-Miller space corresponding to this universal Coxeter group with its canonical decomposition. Each free factor is a group of order 2. I couldn't think of an easier case to work in, of course. And the main result is the following, that this McCullough-Miller space is an accurate geometric model provided n is at least 4. It's really important to have that hypothesis because it's spectacularly false in the case that n is 3, because McCullough-Miller space in that case is the barycentric subdivision of the trivalent tree, which has an uncountable automorphism group. And these are finitely presented groups and definitely countable. So this is far from true in the case n equals 3, and then suddenly 4 is enough. So I'm just going to describe the construction of McCullough-Miller space, and this might some of you might get a smile. In fact, it's a poset, finite poset, and it's got lots of charms. So a hypergraph is a very formal definition here. It's an ordered pair consisting of a set of distinguishable vertices. So vertices are labeled. And a collection of hyperedges, each of which is a subset of the vertices containing at least 2 elements. So a normal graph, an edge connects 2 vertices. You can think of that as a set containing 2 elements. If we don't allow loops, then each set contains 2 elements. We just let edges contain more than 2 elements, and we have hyperedges. I'll show you a way to think about this in a moment, but a graph without loops is a hypergraph in which each hyperedge contains exactly 2 vertices. So it's a generalization of the idea of a graph. And a hypergraph is a hypertree if the corresponding labeled bipartite graph is a tree. I'll show you that in a moment. Oh, I guess I'll bring that up now. So here's two examples of hypergraphs. You just draw your labeled vertices and then indicate this notion of adjacency, which things are contained in a hyperedge. And of course, there's a natural way to translate it into a labeled bipartite graph where these open vertices, which are unlabeled, are just representing the hyperedges. And you connect one of these representations of a hyperedge to the vertices that are in the hyperedge, and you have a labeled bipartite graph. And when you look at it this way, it's easy to see what a hypertree is. A hypergraph is a hypertree if this is a tree. So this example at the top is not a hypertree because it's got a loop. So you can phrase the idea of a walk in terms of the original formulation of a hypergraph, but this is just a quick way to see what's going on. And it's I'm going to write this for the hypertrees on the vertex set 1 through n, and here is we have a formula for computing the number of hypertrees of a given size, and it grows very quickly. It's related to a sum of the Stirling numbers of the second kind, for those who know about these things. And you find in the online encyclopedia of integer sequences. So here are the hypertrees on the numbers 1 through 4. There are 29 of them. And this is called the nuclear hypertree. And there's a natural poset structure. And so these have been arranged to help us see that. And we get the poset structure by an operation called folding. So if two hyperedges overlap in a hypertree, they can only share one vertex in common, otherwise it wouldn't be a hypertree. So they just have one vertex in common. And if we take two distinct hyperedges that intersect non-trivially, we just replace those two hyperedges by their union. And that's called folding. So we could see here if we take this one here that has 4 in the middle, and I just decide that this hyperedge with 2 and 4 and this with 3 and 4 should be folded together, I'll just have 4, 2 and 3. Where did that go? 4, there we go, this one here. So that's the result of folding, and that gives us a poset structure. There's a unique minimal element. When you've folded all the hyperedges, you're left with one hyperedge, you've got a unique minimal element. It's missing a maximal element, so of course these are not, we can forget about regular polytopes, but we can forget about them for another reason as well. So here is this is the simpliter realization of the poset when you have of rank 3. And this is the thing that gets glued together to make the barycentric subdivision of the trivalent tree. This is the link of the poset when the hypertrees on 4 elements. So to see what the simpliter realization should look like, we're supposed to add one more vertex, the nuclear vertex out here, and connect it via an edge to each vertex here. And then when we see triangles, so we set for each of these edges, we'll see a triangle, we're supposed to fill it in. So we're going to cone this picture off to a point, and this edge is actually continued on at the top there. So I took this picture from McCullough and Miller's original paper. So why hypertrees in relation to the group, the automorphism group of the universal Coxeter group? Well, we have this idea that the automorphism group we're interested in is generated by partial conjugations. And there's this definition that makes a connection for us that a partial conjugation is carried by a hypertree, and here's the technical version of it here, but really what it's saying is a partial conjugation is carried by a hypertree if this is a good way to say it. If I'm going to think about 3 conjugating some elements, or maybe 4, I think about 4 conjugating some other A4 conjugating some other generators, this hypertree carries the partial conjugation where 4 acts on 1 and 5, because 1 and 5 make a complete connected component when I remove 4. And it carries the partial conjugation where 4 conjugates 2, 3 and 6, but it does not carry the partial conjugation where 4 just conjugates 5, because I need to take entire connected components. And this definition works really well because it actually captures exactly when 2 partial conjugations commute. 2 partial conjugations commute when they're carried by the same hypertree. So that's the connection between the group theory and this poset. And that's what allowed McCullough and Miller to construct this space. So to construct the space, they begin with one copy of that finite poset, the simpliter realization of that finite poset for each element in this group here. So remember, this was the kernel of that action. That's the infinite part of the group. And the symmetric group was the finite part of the group in the semi-direct product. Then I take one copy of the simpliter complex for each element of this, and the minimal vertex the vertex corresponding to the minimal element could be called the nuclear vertex. Then we're going to take vertices in different copies, become identified when they correspond to the same hypertree. So now that I've got different copies for each element of this group here, I can think of each vertex amongst a vertex in this much bigger collection now is labelled by an element of that group and by a hypertree. So we'll identify 2 vertices when they are labelled by the same hypertree, and when the difference between the corresponding elements of this group, so an alpha inverse beta, is a product of partial conjugations carried by the hypertree. So that's the link between group theory and this construction. And then once you've figured out which vertices go together, you've got to identify the higher dimensional simplices as you go. And then we'll just let the elements of this group act on the space by permuting the copies of the hypertree complex. So permitting the stars of nuclear vertices. So the idea is that we take these pieces here and we glue them, we take one piece for each of these group elements, and we're going to have a group action by permuting these group elements. Now, there's a natural action induced by the fact that these are labelled by these copies are labelled by these group elements. And so McCullough and Miller had already established that what we get now is we have a well-defined action of the semi-direct product of this group with the symmetric group. For the automorphisms of the universal Cox group, that's the entire automorphism group, so that's as nice as the relationship can get. And it's easy to see that this action is injective because, perhaps we'll go back to, we'll go back to something like this. There's an obvious action of the symmetric group on this poset. Just permute the numbers. And one can see that the action of the out zero part is that part acts injectively, and the symmetries act injectively here. So we have an injective action. So what's left to be done to prove the theorem is to show that when I take an what needs to be done to prove the theorem is to show that the action is surjective, as in this complex doesn't have any more automorphisms than the ones that it has been built to carry. So what I wanted to do this was I wanted to fit this into the table and say, here, this is an accurate geometric model. We've got a really good geometric model. Is it just the right one? Because for outer space, which is an excellent geometric model of the automorphisms of a free group, you had to retract onto the spine to get an accurate geometric model. I wanted to know, did I have to retract onto the spine? Was there something like the spine that I needed to use when I wanted to think about this? And the answer is no. McCullough and Miller got it just right. Good for them. Good for us. So there was some work to be done, and again, I apologise, that should have been an OUT0 there. But the idea is we take an arbitrary automorphism, and I have to show that I can write it as a product of something from out 0 and a permutation. So I just had to play the game. First, I had to show that the nuclear vertices are the vertices of maximal valence. And they're obviously the vertices of maximal valence in the hypertree poset. But then when you start gluing copies of the hypertree poset, you start taking vertices that were not, that had smaller valence, but they're now being glued to other vertices and picking up valence. I had to make sure that this was still true. And once we've got that, then F maps the star of the nuclear vertex of a nuclear vertex to the star of any other of another nuclear vertex, and by construction, this acts transitively on the stars and nuclear vertices, so we've picked up our element of out zero so that this fixes setwise the star of the nuclear vertex corresponding to the identity automorphism. And then this took me longer than I wanted it to. I had to show that the only automorphisms of the hypertree poset were the ones coming from the symmetric group. That was fun in the end, but it wasn't fun when I couldn't figure it out. That tells me that this is far from being like the structures. The hypertree poset is really not like the structures that have been discussed at this workshop, because in this workshop we have lots of symmetries. This only has a few. And then once we've done that, I had to show that adjacent copies of the hypertree poset in this construction shared so many things in common that once one was fixed point-wise, the ones next to it, enough of them are fixed that they have to be locked in place, and then by induction we get where we want to go. And I think I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much. Now, the case n equals 3 is really not true. The construction gives you so McCullough-Miller space for this group gives you the barycentric subdivision of the trivalent tree. So you take the tree and just put a vertex, new vertex on each edge. And so that the automorphism group of that is uncountably infinite. But the outer automorphism group of W3 is countable. So really what fails is what fails in this instance is this part here, where the copies of the hypertree poset when glued together are not so enmeshed that when one's fixed pointwise, the next one has to be fixed pointwise, because you only have these three edges, and when one's fixed, the other two can be interchanged. And that gives you lots more, many more automorphisms. It is, yes, this... Oh yes, so that's well, that's known, and it was interesting work, and it was done. Let's see. Yes, for the automorphisms of the trees and so on. I was thinking for the outer automorphism groups of these free products. That's sort of various theory of that that's been done. An Englishman called McGill recently and redid some work, but. Original. Oh yes, yes, yes. So these groups have been studied, but they're geometric groups and the relationship to geometric structure. The goal was to show that the geometric space that we had was already the right one. Yeah. That's what the online encyclopedia of integer sequences is really good for, because people list the same sequence. So if you go there, you'll see some other things. And one of the claims to fame is that it was Donald Knuth who listed that this was how you count hypertrees. And it's nice to be connected, have any topic connected to his name. Great, great. Yes, well, thank you for that. I'll look at that. Thank you.
Okay, so no more questions, please join me in thanking Adam.
Thank you.